This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Another mega heat wave, and Uncle Frank claims the global warming scare is a hoax. Susan at work rails against masks and vaccines, even when half the staff are off sick. Most of us have someone like that in our lives. If scientists discover how the world works and can prove it, why doesn't everyone understand? We all want to know. So does Philip Fernbach. At the University of Colorado Boulder, he is a cognitive scientist and professor of marketing at the Leeds School of Business. Philip is co-author of the book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Fernbach's co-authored paper in the journal Science is dead on. Knowledge over confidence is associated with anti-consensus views on controversial scientific issues. Let's investigate what people think they know. Philip Fernbach, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
A big majority of scientists accept things like evolution, the Big Bang theory, and climate change. They produce mountains of studies drawing on all the verifiable facts they can find. Why doesn't that information flow out easily to everyone?
That's sort of the $65,000 question right there. There's a lot of nuance and complexity to the answer. But very briefly, to sort of start our conversation, what I would say is that as human beings, we tend to know relatively little as individuals. The world is wildly complex. And as individuals, we just can't possibly master that much in terms of knowledge of the world. And instead, what makes human beings special is not our ability as individuals to know a ton, but our ability to form into communities where different people have different bits of information, and we have what we call communities of knowledge. We participate in communities of knowledge. So as an individual, I might not have enough information to actually form a reasoned judgment about whether climate change is a real thing and so on. But what I can do is I can draw on other people in my community who know more than I do, and I can reach a position that way. That's kind of how we form positions as human beings in these groups, these communities. And the problem arises because sometimes our communities get things wrong. And as individuals, we both don't know enough to really know when we've got things wrong, but we also tend to suffer from overconfidence about our own personal knowledge. By virtue of participating in these communities, we feel like we understand these issues better than we do. So if everyone in your community is saying that they have a particular position on climate change or some other complex issue, we sort of nod along and we don't realize that we ourselves lack the information to make a reasoned judgment. And so we become stuck in our ways, and it can be very hard to actually break through that, because if someone comes along and says, no, you've got it wrong, it's very easy for me to fall back on the idea that people in my community told me such and such, or I understand the issue myself, and I'm not really going to listen to you because I sort of already have an understanding of this issue. So that's sort of a one-minute answer to probably a much more complex and nuanced situation.
So how large is the population who dispute what most scientists agree is reality?
That's a great question. It really is issue-dependent. So for some issues, it's very prevalent. For instance, we've done a lot of work on people's rejection of genetically modified foods, and that's an issue where opposition is very, very high, and many, many people are scared of GMOs, think they're unsafe, and that kind of stuff. In contrast with what the experts tend to say. And those numbers are even higher in Europe, actually, relative to the U.S., but it can be, you know, more than half of the population. For other kinds of issues, they tend to be, you know, like a rejection of climate change is another one, which is very prevalent, and tends to break down very strongly along partisan lines. Other issues, like, for instance, vaccine hesitancy or rejection of vaccination, those tend to be a smaller number, maybe on the order of 10% or so. But even a small number like that can be very problematic because it can lead to people not getting vaccinated, and that can lead to, for instance, reaching herd immunity slower as a population, which makes a pandemic drag on, for instance. So a lot of these things are fairly prevalent, but it really is issue-specific.
Well, it also led to people calling themselves truckers, but they were anti-vaccination people, taking over the capital of Canada for 3 weeks last year. So it can get pretty extreme. Now, if people doubt climate science, Are they also more likely to discount vaccination or to believe that homeopathy works? Is this a broad characteristic, a kind of personality type that rejects authority?
I think there is some component of that, but it does not explain everything. So there are people who are, in general, more suspicious of expertise, and they will take a contrarian position on a lot of different things. But what we see in our data is a lot of variability across issues in terms of who the people are who maintain those positions. So some positions are much more partisan in nature, and some are more evenly distributed across different ideological groups. So, for instance, I mentioned genetically modified foods and vaccination. Both of those actually, in our data, tend not to break along partisan lines. Vaccination is changing somewhat because of COVID being very polarized, so you get more rejection of the COVID vaccine specifically. But historically, things like homeopathic medicine, vaccination, and other kinds of things, you have people who have very strong opinions both on the left and the right about those issues. And so it's really about extremity more so than it is about ideology.
Why do people become so passionate about their knowledge? I mean, they can get really angry. Why the heat?
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned the paper that we published a few months ago, which I think is a pretty important finding. And the result is that when we look at the people with the strongest counter-consensus views on a lot of these issues that we're talking about, they have the lowest levels of objective knowledge. So if you actually test them on their understanding of the science, they score the lowest. But if you ask them how well they understand the technology or the specific science around these issues, they actually have the strongest feeling of understanding. So we call that subjective knowledge. So it's kind of a perverse effect, which is that they have this huge gap between what they know and what they think they know. That's what sort of characterizes these people who have these very strong counter-consensus views. And I think that is part of the answer to your question, which is that when we have this overconfidence about our knowledge, it can really support a very passionate and strong view because we feel like we understand the issue and we have sort of an overly simplified view of it. The other thing that is a big part of the answer to your question is these communities that I talked about before. Issues tend to get polarized because within a community, people take on a particular view, and then outside of the people outside of the community, they don't trust. And within the community, they do trust. And then what happens is, as by being a member of the community, these views become more than just knowledge or just something that you believe. They become part of your identity about who you are. In that situation, you're going to want to defend your positions very strongly. And so you might not necessarily be open-minded to hearing counter-evidence, or you might dismiss the counter-evidence and think you're listening to it, but not really taking it on board, and very passionately wanting to defend your position. When I teach what we call belief updating, so how do you change your beliefs in the light of new evidence to my students, I talk about the distinction between what a scientist does and what a lawyer does. And a scientist, well, a good scientist, not, you know, science is a complex social phenomenon, but what an idealized view of science is that we try to get to the truth by taking on evidence and revising our beliefs. A lawyer tries to defend their position, whatever it is. And so, you know, we are often lawyers when it comes to these things more so than when we are scientists.
And we tend to think of self-affirming but ignorant people as perhaps poor or rural or uneducated. But your study found education is not a protection against anti-science?
Okay, so the answer to your question is a little more complex than that. What we look at is the relationship between knowledge of a particular issue and then, in general, how that predicts the strength of these counter-consensus views. We do also look at education level and use that as what we call a control. So if we control for education and we look at issue-specific knowledge or general science literacy, it's still the case that that predicts having an extreme view. And so I think what you said is correct, which is that two people that have differing levels of education, the person with the lower level of science knowledge is going to tend to have the more extreme view. But I do think that education in general does correlate with having more extreme views, about more extreme counter-consensus views. And that's because, you know, education leads, for instance, to learning more about the scientific consensus, sort of learning more about the complexity of the issue and so on. But this is not just about low education people. High education people can be susceptible and prone also to having kind of incorrect beliefs about science. It happens all the time.
I don't know. Our top public health officer in British Columbia just told a televised press conference that masks do not really help in a pandemic. And she said that the COVID doesn't really spread in kids at school, so schools are safe. So it sounds like anti-science, well, we won't even mention a former president, some anti-science can penetrate to the top of governments.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially when it becomes polarized in that way, because it can be a very powerful thing. You know, if you're a member of that community and those are the views of the community, you're going to take on those views sort of habitually, and they're going to be part of who you are. It's part of your identity. It's very hard to change. And so we definitely see misinformation. I mean, you know, I don't know the Canadian news as well as I do in America, but in America, we use the word epidemic, but we've had an epidemic of false beliefs, misinformation sort of exploding into the public eye. And some of these things are really extreme, crazy things, like the QAnon conspiracy theory, which contends that there's this cabal of pedophiles controlling world events and so on. And that really exploded into the mainstream here because it became a very popular conspiracy theory among a lot of people, you know, a significant proportion of people, and was even, you know, nodded to by people in our government as well. So we're seeing the same kinds of things in the U.S. as you are in Canada, for sure.
And you've talked about community several times, but that definition is really changing somewhat because of the pandemic isolating us and people's tendency to go online more. And we see that Google and YouTube are more likely to suggest anti-science information about global warming than they are this show. They had to rewrite their algorithms to avoid promoting damaging information on misinformation on COVID. Can we blame the internet for connecting formerly isolated extremists into clubs and online echo communities?
I think it's a huge issue, absolutely. And it's not, it didn't start with COVID. You know, it's been going on for several years. And they call this idea filter bubbles. And there's actually a lot of academic research on the extent to which filter bubbles really exist and so on. But it seems absolutely true to me that people are getting a lot of their information via social media in networks that are sort of isolated from counter-information or in which the counter-information can't really penetrate. And that's a huge, huge problem. I talked quite a bit about this visit that I made a few years ago to the meeting of the Flat Earth International Organization, which is a group of flat earthers. And they really believe that the Earth is flat. And I went to their conference in Denver, their international conference in Denver, and it was fascinating. But one thing I definitely learned there is the power of the community to help sustain these kinds of beliefs, because people are all there. It's almost like a religious revelry where everybody is partying and having a great time talking about this stuff. And all of the information flow is happening within the community. So they're all talking to each other. And there's sort of, it becomes an in-group, out-group sort of situation where the counter-information is easily dismissed because it's coming from people who don't trust, whereas all of the information to verify the beliefs about flat Earth, which is a pretty, you know, pretty extreme, pretty wild view of the world, it's all coming from within the community. And the reason I think that flat Earth took off over the last few years, flat Earth beliefs have been around since the Middle Ages, these groups that are trying to reject the heliocentric view of the solar system, and they've been around for a long time, but they really took off with the proliferation of the internet, because now people can search up YouTube videos, they see the YouTube videos, and the YouTube videos, you know, create this community, and everybody can sort of interact together via the internet in a way that's much easier than it was, you know, say 20 or 30 years ago, when people were writing newsletters and communicating via snail mail, and then occasionally getting together with some other people who have the same views at conferences and so on. Nowadays, it's just so much easier for these communities to form and to proliferate.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is cognitive scientist Dr. Philip Fehrenbach from the University of Colorado, and we're looking at how false knowledge could block out established scientific truth. You studied and published on polarization in society and at one point suggested it might be somewhat overblown. Talk to us about your February 2022 article in Current Opinion in Psychology.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So that paper is a review paper of a phenomenon that's called false polarization. And the term false polarization is a little misleading. So the idea is we have polarization, obviously. So people on both sides of the aisle have views that differ. I mean, that's polarization. Polarization takes many forms. There's issue polarization, so we have different views on the issues. There's also what's called affect polarization. That's the idea that we think that people on the other side of the aisle are bad. We think that they're evil, that they're insensitive, and all these other kinds of things. So there's various kinds of polarization. But false polarization is the idea that if I ask you about somebody on the other side, how strongly do they feel, you actually over-exaggerate the extent of polarization. So that's called false polarization. So in the U.S., if I'm a Democrat, I think all Republicans have these very strong views on all the issues, and everybody has the same view on the other side. And likewise, if I'm a Republican making judgments about Democrats, if you actually ask the people about their views, they're more nuanced, and there's more variability within their ideological group. They're not as extreme, and so on and so forth. So what we did in that paper is reviewed all the literature suggesting that, in fact, false polarization does exist. And it's a major problem because if my view is that you have this really extreme view on the other side, I'm not really going to be open to talking to you or trying to negotiate with you because it seems pointless. And so I think this false polarization actually ends up contributing to real polarization. And what we do in the paper is we talk about some of the psychological phenomena that we think are responsible for false polarization. And we talk about things like what we call categorical thinking. Categorical thinking is the idea that we tend to think in terms of categories. And when we think in terms of categories, we think about sort of the prototypical member of that category. So if I think of a Republican, I don't think of an average Republican. I think of a prototypical Republican who has very strong extreme views that are very different from mine if I'm a Democrat, and vice versa if I'm a Republican thinking about what a Democrat is like. You know, you're picturing somebody with much more extreme views than the average. And another thing we talk about is the idea of oversimplification. We tend to think of everybody having these views, and we oversimplify the issue and think about it in like black and white terms, whereas most real-world issues are really complex. Like you mentioned masking before, like the question of masking is a really complex one that has to do with the costs and benefits of masking, which are all probabilistic. And it's not like we should all be wearing masks all the time forever. That might reduce transmission of disease, but also is not something that most people would want. And it's also not like we should never have masks under any conditions. You know, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle and is a weighing of costs and benefits. But when we oversimplify the issue, it becomes black and white, like masks, yes versus no. And then that happens a lot as well. So that can lead to this false polarization as well, because I think that everybody on the other side of the aisle has this very black and white view and doesn't actually have any nuance to what they believe.
So some opponents of well-accepted scientific ideas tell us they are expressing their individuality and that they're self-taught. They may know more than the doctors or the scientists. In your book with Steve Sloman, though, as a cognitive scientist, you find that's pretty unlikely. You say, we never think alone. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most important ideas in our book, is the idea that human cognition is really not built for individual thinking. And a lot of people do kind of, I think, have the misperception that the highest form of intelligence is really about individual thinking. Like, how smart am I? How much can I figure out? And so on. How much information can I process? How much do I know? All that kind of stuff. But if you think about anything that human beings do, it requires this massive collaboration. You know, just look around the room that you're sitting in. Like, there's no one individual who could create any of the technology that's around us, you know, or, you know, society is just this massively, massively collaborative activity where no one individual is capable of, you know, any small percentage of what we have as human beings, our technology, our social systems, all of that kind of stuff. And so thinking really evolved for the group, for many people to be able to come together and jointly pursue complex activities, complex goals. That's really what makes people special. If you say, what differentiates us from other animals? It's our ability to collaborate in these massive communities where we can pursue arbitrarily complex goals despite no one individual knowing all that much. So, you know, Steve and I both believe that this idea of the sort of lone thinker is a really misplaced way to think about what human beings are really evolved for, like what we're really for, and what we should celebrate and laud is not individual thinking. It's the ability to help a group, to help contribute to a group pursuing complex goals. How well can you do that?
And so when confronted with a person who defies science, we want an answer. How can we reach that individual? But with your book, The Knowledge Illusion, it sounds like we need to find a strategy to change movements of thought instead of individual solutions. What do you think?
That's a great observation. I mean, this is the really difficult part of all of this, which is that the very foundational and fundamental nature of thinking is that it pushes us towards kind of overestimation of our knowledge and closed-mindedness, because we form into these communities, and as individuals, it can be very hard to appreciate when we have things wrong. That's not necessarily like only a bad thing, right? Like, as I said, human beings achieve amazing things by virtue of this ability to form into groups where we can collaborate and work together despite no individual having all of the information. So trying to break through that is extremely difficult. And so we can sort of think about two directions of influence. One would be bottom up and one would be top down. Bottom up is to sort of try to promote, in general, people having a little more intellectual humility, getting people to learn to check their own understanding and question more, to be more deliberative, to be more thoughtful, to be more careful about the kind of views that we take on. When we are projecting some strong view about some complex issue, do we really understand it that well? And so trying to teach that as sort of a general principle, intellectual humility, because the world is really complex, is an important thing. I think that is part of the answer, but it's a little idealistic, right? The other thing that we can do is that we can try to do some kind of top-down interventions, because that will influence the community and hope that filters down to the individuals. There's various ways to think about what those top-down interventions could be. For instance, one of them could be interventional policies within social media to avoid misinformation and all that kind of stuff. And other ones can be trying to influence thought leaders within communities. So you can actually influence, you know, some of the leaders that you talked about and get them to realize and appreciate that they don't have the science right. Maybe that will filter down. Of course, all of these things are really difficult. And moreover, they all raise really challenging questions about things like free speech, which are not easily adjudicated either, because we also want to have freedom to express views and so on. So the question of when does a top-down intervention, a policy intervention on social media, become a restriction of free speech, that's a really difficult one. That's something that, for instance, Twitter is under their new leadership, that's the big struggle that they're trying to figure out. You know, to what extent should we have a more free and open environment where misinformation can flow versus how do we restrict that kind of thing? And there's no easy answers to any of this. And that's why this issue of why it's such a challenging and almost intractable problem, you know, we look around and we say, how can people in this day and age still believe in a QAnon conspiracy theory? But these forces that create that are so powerful. There's no sort of magic bullet, no silver bullet, I think, to solve these problems. It's a matter of coming at it from both of these different directions and trying a lot of different things.
Philip, you are also a professor in marketing at a business school in Colorado. In another study, you found even investors had unhelpful illusions about their own performance. How does this work in the business world?
So that's another interesting phenomenon. What we found is that one reason that investors are overconfident is because they misremember the past. And that's one place that overconfidence comes from. If you only remember your successes and you forget your failures, you're going to tend to be overconfident. And that's what we found with investors. So we asked them about their past returns, their past trades, and asked them to report their best and worst trades, their sort of most impactful trades. And then we had them look up their actual performance and report that back to us. And what we found is that people tend to remember their winners and forget their losers, and also misremember the magnitudes of those things, such that the past is more rosy than it actually was. And the extent to which they had that bias also predicted the extent to which they were overconfident about their ability to beat the market in the future. Financial decisions are obviously some of the most important that we make, and people tend to be overconfident about those things as well. So overconfidence is a pretty prevalent and rampant psychological bias that creates a lot of problems.
Well, we're not going to be able to cover it all. I wish I could talk to you about your project from a few years ago called Opening Minds by Exposing the Illusion of Understanding. I'll bet you we could spend a long time on that one as well. But I think people probably came into this hoping to find a solution for Uncle Frank or Susan at the office, the people who deny things that seem obvious to science. Do you have any suggestions on how we can help?
Let me finish by being a little more concrete about that kind of a situation. Here's what I would say. Do not try to change their mind. I think what you should instead do is you should ask a lot of questions. And the idea would be that instead of being in an advocacy mindset, you're in an explanatory mindset. An advocacy mindset means that you're going to advocate for your position and tell them why they're wrong. And that's not a very effective mode. For the reasons that I talked about already, people are going to be defensive. They're going to fall back on what they already believe, and they're not going to listen to you. And in fact, you yourself might probably don't understand the issue in a lot of depth either. That's kind of the nature of these things. What you should instead do is try to learn. Like, why is it that this person maintains the view that they do? And try to understand what is kind of the best version of what they're trying to say. And in the process of jointly trying to explain the issue together, that now you're in sort of a cooperative environment. And the idea would be that you're not trying to change people's mind. What you're instead trying to do is open them up to the fact that maybe the issue is more complex and there's more going on than they had initially thought. So the goal should not be to change. The goal should be to open. And in the process, you might open your own mind and realize that actually you don't understand it in that much depth. And then maybe you can make a plan together to learn more. Okay, let's look this up, actually. Let's do a little work together. And I think that what you will find if you engage in that kind of explanatory rather than advocacy approach is that you're going to feel much better. You will both feel much better at the end than if you sit there and shout at each other and you both leave the dinner table, saying, man, what an idiot. Right? So I think that's my concrete advice to you. And it can be challenging. It can be difficult because sometimes, I don't remember what name you use, but aunt whatever or uncle whatever seems to be very close-minded and doesn't want to listen and has everything wrong and can just give you sound bites from whatever source you think is completely ridiculous. But you have to be patient and go into it with a learning mindset. Most people love their family members, even if they get frustrated by them. So that's what I would say is, you know, go in with a warmth and a desire to learn and a feeling, like a positive feeling of this person's not an idiot. They're not a terrible person. What they are is, you know, maybe a human being. And so let's go in this with the idea of not trying to change their mind, but trying to open their mind and trying at the same time to open your own.
This paper on knowledge over confidence is open access. It's free for anybody to read. You can find it in the journal Science, published July 2022. As always, I will put lots of links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. From the University of Colorado Boulder, Dr. Fernbach, thank you for sharing your mind with our listeners.
Totally my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Radio EcoShock.
The tool of logic used by Fernbach and his colleagues may find hostile reception in some fields in some of my listeners. For example, it sounds like Fernbach thinks scientists agree that genetically modified foods are safe and good, and so is nuclear power. I don't think that. Have I been filled with alternative facts or blinded by a cultural preference? With nuclear power, there is a consensus among geopolitical historians that countries with nuclear power have a heightened ability to produce nuclear weapons. We presume there is a scientific consensus that using nuclear weapons on cities and in large numbers of people is a bad thing. But even with a proven link, how can one consensus, pro-nuke power, survive the consequences of following a consensus against it due to nuclear weapons dangers? So in this study, Fernbach and his colleagues asked about this consensus. Nuclear power is necessary and should be expanded to mitigate climate change. Really? In over 500 interviews with scientists, perhaps one person said that. Consensus on human-induced climate change, evolution, and the Big Bang Theory? Well, that's easy to find. Some have mass statements signed by tens of thousands of scientists. But most sources claiming a consensus for nuclear to help solve climate change come from the nuclear industry or people known to be in their orbit. The two citations in Fehrenbach et al. To back this nuclear assumption are weak. I tracked them down. This should have been removed from this study. But I still find the basic conclusions of the paper really helpful for all of us.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.